Hi, everybody. It's Jim Bakei, and the podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. I'm really, really lucky and happy today to have my good friend, golfing partner, and the founder of Shipsticks, a great global company, Nick Coleman. Nick, great to have you here today.
Jim, thanks a lot for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So, Nick, why don't you just give me a little background on you. Born and raised, Reader's Digest version, as I like to say about it.
I was born and raised in the Northeast, went to school in the Northeast. And after college, I ended up working on Wall Street for a little while and later moved down to Florida to work for a hedge fund. During that time period when working at the hedge fund, the fund had blown up and it was time to kind of rethink what we were doing. And at that point, I was in my 30s. And so kind of halfway through what I would call my adult earning years. And it was a real pivotal time point to think about, hey, do I want to jump ship here? Or do I want to stay on a consistent path that I know will get me to, theoretically, will get me to where I'd like to be so that I can provide the following things for my family? Whatever those things were, you know, there's a steady path that one can take that has some aspect or level of certainty. And then there's the entrepreneurial path, which has lots of ups and downs and can be super exciting and super successful and not successful, but you still learn a significant amount along the way. I had just gotten married. We were thinking about having kids. And so there was a significant amount of responsibility that I'm looking at that's coming right at me in the future. Needless to say, I jumped ship recklessly and said, hey, I'll try and start a business that doesn't really exist, that nobody really does. I have no data to support that this business is going to work. There are two giant behemoths in the current industry that represent more than 5% of total GDP. And I'm going to try and go to bat with them. And I'm going to try and beat them at a game that they do. And that was kind of, you know, reckless thinking, but that's where opportunity lies.
I can only imagine what your wife said, because I always love these moments, right? This is the critical moment. Do I listen to the conventional wisdom of everybody saying to me, are you out of your mind? Or come to the realization, they don't know any more than I do. And why am I asking for their opinion, right?
Correct. So I should have prefaced my original work experience. So I worked on Wall Street throughout the 90s and during college. And I had a very good financial background and a path that was going to be paved and a pretty predictable path. And I interrupted that path in 98 and 99 to launch a internet gaming company. I had some experience in ventures prior. And the first venture, we raised some money. We started to generate some revenue. Some circumstances changed. We had to pivot. We sold the business. Not a big success. Then launched another business in the gaming world that ultimately became a success. So I had some failures to look back on that provided a good, healthy sense of fear. If you don't do this right, you get to do it all over again, right?
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I've got my dad beating me over the head, being like, hey, stupid, you know, follow this path. And so that was a conflict in my life from, not a conflict, but something I kind of fought with originally, kind of which way the path is being led for me and which way do I want to actually build my own path? You have to listen to what the others are saying, but then you also have to focus on what it is that you want.
So it's interesting because I'm sure at every juncture, every entrepreneur, you know, realizes that when they do something like you've done or anything else, there's nothing to look back on and sort of go, who did this before and what can I learn before? So you get to the point, so you're going to launch Shipsticks and you come up with the question, why doesn't someone do this? Or someone's doing a shitty job at it and I can do it better. And in your case, it's both, right?
Yeah, and a little bit more. Shipping golf clubs, I'm a person who loves convenience and is happy to pay for certain services or experiences if they meet my expectation. I would always ship my golf club. So I'd walk into the pro shop and I'm going to use some random names and some random places, right? And I'd be like, hey, Jim, you know, how much does it cost to ship my clubs to Pebble Beach? And Jim would be like, okay, I'm not sure. I'll check FedEx. Types online, says, cost to ship your clubs are $150. And I said, great, Jim, thanks. Let's ship them to Pebble Beach. So go to Pebble Beach. 45 days later, I received my statement from the club and I get a bill for $750. So I take that statement. I call Jim the pro and I'm like, hey, Jim, I don't understand this. You quoted me $150 and now I'm getting a bill for $750. There's a massive disconnect between the quoted and the actual price with shipping golf clubs. And so when I went and confronted the pro, he was like, Nick, I didn't upcharge you. That's the charge that I received back. And that's because the costing of the shipping of clubs is not based on the quote, but it's actually based on the dimensional sizing of the product right. that shipped. And so I was like, wow, I had a great experience with shipping clubs, really bad experience on the billing side, tumultuous experience with the pro that could have gone either way because maybe I couldn't afford to pay $750. I was appalled by paying $750. And I was like, that's just not right. And so part of that premise of building ShipSticks was to say, hey, can I commoditize the price of golf bag shipping? Can I make the actual price the same as the quoted price so that a consumer has some understanding and visibility into the costing side of the product that we're offering? And if I can, well, can I cram down that pricing to make it palatable and affordable, more like the quoted price so that other people will do that? And so that was kind of the premise, right? And it was the same time, similar time to when Groupon really took off. And that concept of leveraging the buying power of the masses to offer discounted services and solutions was a thesis that resonated with me. And I was like, wow, if I can apply that same volume aggregation model to the concept of commoditizing golf bag shipping, maybe I have a market opportunity. Concept, ship golf clubs. Pricing for golf clubs needs to be comparable and palatable for as many consumers as possible. And how do you do that? Through volume aggregation. Now, in every city, there's 10 million great ideas, right? Everyone's got a great idea, but it's a function of being able to execute that good idea that allows for success or penetration and building of a company. And so now I've got a great idea and people are like, that's great, but FedEx can do that. UPS can do that. DHL can do that. They actually do that. So what are you going to do it differently than what they do? How do you think you're going to build a business around it? FedEx and UPS are the best and DHL are the best in the business, right? They are superb at moving product from point A to point B. They are the supply chain, right? For all intent and purposes, they are the cream of the crop. They are the best, and they are the only ones that really can do it. I should mention Amazon's probably very good at it too, but from a consumer's perspective that utilizes them on a B2C model, those major guys are the best of breed. What we started to focus in on was the customer service, attention to detail, technology, what these pros know and don't know, and do these larger organizations that focus their sales efforts on larger opportunity sets, are they really going to get that granular and that nitpicky to pick up one golf bag here, one golf bag there, and does that make sense? We realized that if we could aggregate volume by picking off one golf bag here, one piece of luggage here, we could start building volume and amassing volume. And if we offer and layered customer service on top of that, you start building brand. The function of building brand is equally as important, if not more important than building revenue. Brand is what carries you through, brand reputation, brand recognition. And so becoming a provider, we are a company, we'd always say we are a company of golfers for golfers. FedEx, UPS, DHL, the best in the business at shipping stuff. We focus heavily on moving golf bags from golf club to golf club. We understand how golf clubs operate and how various shipping and receiving locations move bags and packages inside of resorts and companies and facilities. And the larger logistics providers, that's not their business. Their business is getting it from A to B. Our business is from getting it from A to B's room or A to B's golf course to the first hole, right? Or it's getting it from the 18th to your house or your hotel room or from your office you know, to wherever you're going. Like with skis, we have a company called Ship Skis where we get it to the mountain.
The business starts to take off. There is no amount of money golfers won't pay for convenience. Longer drives are straighter things, right? It's a great target market. And what I love that you created is it's like Kleenex or certain names that the name of the company became generic with the process of what you did. And so when people talk about your, they don't talk about, oh, I'm shipping my sticks. They say, I'm going to ship sticks them. And it's such a great honor to you and to your company that people see it in that way. So the company grows and grows and grows. You're looking at expansion, and I've used your company on a number of occasions. And I've told you, and I will say this to people, never met a nicer bunch of people, more friendly and more hospitable on the other end of the line, especially the first few times that I got on and I was kind of like, okay. So like ask, and they're like, no problem. No, don't worry. We'll get it sorted out. We'll have it there. You know, just really relieving you. Cause you know, I think shipping your golf clubs as a true golfer is probably a riskier proposition than putting your kids on a plane alone. I'm only joking for all of you out there, but if you're a golfer, you understand that. So we fast forward, everything's going really well. Company's growing, you're hiring people, you're a global company, you're expanding into different things. Boom, the wall comes.
Yeah, so if we were to go back a few months, we'd been experiencing rapid growth and we had been expanding product offerings based on customer demands and needs and wants and, you know, listening to those respective requests. And in October of 19, we acquired our largest competitor 3.5 months before the world shut down and planes were grounded. Coming into February, we started to notice volume and product delays in various parts of the country and more so at ports and in various parts of the world. And we started getting very nervous. We were invited to go to the Super Bowl and we passed. And it was all because of what was going on in Europe on the supply chain side. And that was a telltale sign to us that there was a global problem emerging. And we faced one of the hardest decisions of my life ever. The week of February 28th, I remember it very distinctly, we furloughed like 90 employees.
Out of how many?
Out of like 130, our core group of employees that were dedicated young folks. That was a very, very tough time for me and challenging time where I had to look some kid in the face and say, I'm really sorry, man, but we got to furlough you and send you home. You know, tears and yelling and screaming. And we're sitting there like, it wasn't your fault. This isn't corporate greed taking over. This is survival. Like we're looking down the barrel of the gun. This was 3 weeks before they shut down the world. So we were lucky to be ahead of it. But nonetheless, the point that I was getting at is those are not things that one would foresee in business or in the course of business where you have to let go whatever number it may be. Maybe it's five, maybe you're a smaller company, maybe you're a much larger company. You had to let go of 2,000 or 3,000. Nonetheless, I had never done that. We were just preparing. We're like, hey guys, don't know if this is going to be real, but we're going to cut our spends. We're going to furlough people. And it's my hopes that we're going to call you guys in 30 days and bring you back. Right. And that was the toughest experience of my professional career. And I've had ups, downs all around. So we got stay-at-home orders. We've got grounded planes. And my livelihood rests on golfers traveling.
And they were closing golf courses.
Oh, yeah. Everything was closed. This is a really big problem. And what are we going to do? And we were lucky. We fortified the balance sheet. You know, we cut our costs. We stripped all of our spends. We negotiated everything that we possibly could to bring down our operating costs, to furlough the business for our function was for 2 years. So we had enough capital to survive on a very lean team for 2 years. And we had to just sit and think that through for a little while.
I cannot overemphasize what Nick just said there, how important this is for entrepreneurs. You need to have capital set aside. You cannot run skinny because you have to prepare for something that is unpreparable for, that you cannot foresee in the future. Lots of people think that, oh, I don't need to raise this money, right? I don't need to, I can run it down. But that one thing allowed you to survive, wasn't it?
That's right. This is a really bad saying or a motto, but we had to go ugly early. You raise capital when you can, not when you need to. Like, that's the difference of controlling the destiny of your company, is padding the balance sheet when you're capable and making sure you have enough reserves for the unforeseen. Like, we were very lucky. We had run out of capital in some of my other businesses, and we had gotten into very onerous terms when we were raising capital from VCs and from private equity. And so I understood the pain points associated with raising capital. That was one of my early lessons of cash is king, and you need to have deployable cash to provide life.
So you get through, so batten down the hatches for quite a while. There was no light at the end of the tunnel. And then again, as a leader, as you were seeing the beginning of the end coming, were you a leader again at all of a sudden seeing the loosening a bit, a little more?
Yeah, so that's a more happy topic. But March and April, the business tanked, but we still were shipping hundreds of bags a day and couldn't understand how we were generating revenue when all the planes were grounded. We miraculously had light 45 days into this, or 40 days into it. And we're like, huh, okay, here's our floor, right? And so we started slowly but surely bringing people back and starting to loosen up and started spending a little bit of dollars. But to your question, did we see the opening? You know, the supply chain didn't crunch until 2 or 3 months into it. The aftermath and the effects that people are feeling now, which is effectively 2 years later, we've been waiting through those waters, dealing with these issues on the supply chain. Like, we had to build new tech to augment the deficiencies and the challenges that the logistics providers were facing. And that's what allowed us to be best of breed. So when the logistics providers are delivering at 60%, their effective delivery rates used to be 98, 99%. There's a point in time in the last 2 years where they're delivering in the 60s. And so if we have a service that delivers at 60, 65%, we don't have a business anymore. And so we spent the last year and a half for 2 years figuring out how to really augment and infiltrate their networks to increase and enhance our effective delivery rates so that we could be up at the 99%. We're just now starting to see the light because of the capital that was deployed by the major logistics providers and by the respective governments to enhance the overall infrastructure of the supply chain that dealt with the increased demand of e-commerce and shipping in general. And so we navigated through that. Now that it's opening up, we see a significant amount of expansion, growth, speed in effective delivery, and reliability inside of those networks. Yes, everybody hears about supply chain woes. And yes, people see on the news the ships at sea and the ports being backed up and all this stuff. And that's a component of it. What they don't see was the labor shortages and the COVID requirements and the mandates for social distancing and spacing, which put even a greater crunch on the network. And now that's starting to loosen and things are starting to go back towards, I'll call normal. I hate that expression of, oh, we're getting back to normal, but we're getting back to the way it was and we're going to operate. We may have new operating protocols, but services are better, right? And so we're starting to see that now. And so we've started spending again. We're back growing faster than we were in the beginning of 20. We beat 19, we beat 20 and 21. We're leaner, we're smarter, we're more efficient. We did things in 20 that no CEO would ever do in the times of good. And that is, we ratcheted down and stopped all spending to figure out where we are being inefficient. And so the last 2 years allowed us to become significantly more efficient in how we operated, which has led to some of our successes.
Isn't that the real power of adversity? sometimes the best decisions you make are ones that you don't have a choice but have to make, and you have to make it instinctively, right? And when you're in a survival mode, whether it's individual or company or whatever, there is no bad decision here. I have to make a decision. So bring us to today. So where are we in terms of what are you shipping? Where's the big opportunities for you going forward?
So today, prior to the pandemic, we had had three verticals. Now we have five verticals. Also during that time period, we developed all of our strategic partners and distribution points and syndication points for the time period at which the tailwinds were behind us. And so we really went to prepare ourselves for success so that we were set up for when the winds were at our back. And so now we've got a vertical called ShipGo, which is a white glove luggage shipping service. We have a higher end luggage shipping service called Luggage Free. And we launched a camp company called Ship Camps. And that vertical is going to be a very, very powerful contributor and significant force inside of camps. Because if you think about camps and you think about the logistics of getting a young kid to camp and the logistics from the perspective of managing the travel itineraries, hundreds of campers from the camp's perspective, it's a comprehensive, difficult task to be put on the camps. And when safety and concern and frictionless travel and less time in airports is at top of mind and is topical to a lot of parents and to a lot of camps, providing them a method to alleviate a lot of those concerns and make their trips to camp a little more efficient was something that really resonated with camps, and that's shipcamps.com. The other verticals, people started shipping a lot of luggage during the pandemic because they wanted to avoid baggage claims. Then they figured out that that's a smarter way to travel. I don't have to get to the airport early. I don't have to pay to check the bag in. So some of those aggravations and those concerns and the anxiety, and really, I'd like to picture a world kind of like the Jetsons.
It's absolutely true. And you know, the worst thing I hate about going to airports with a bag is when you're at the counter, they want to charge you $75 or $50 on, but then once you get through security, they'll do it for free. And I'm like, could you do something that would piss me off any more than that?
That's something they've realized in through the pandemic is the additional resources and manpower that's required at gates and at baggage claims and unloading and loading the planes and the aggravation and hassles and the brand reputation risk that they get with not delivering on said promise. And so I think there will be a seismic shift in the way that people travel.
There's nothing I love more than great entrepreneurial stories. But the only thing I love more than that is really great people, good people like you, Nick, who come up with a great idea, build it, suffer through some very difficult times, come out the other end even better. And you're a shining example of be you, the world will adjust. And I encourage all of you to go to these five verticals. If you have kids going to camp, skis, bags, golf clubs, luggage, go to those verticals. I know as a client, it's incredibly easy. And at the end of the day, it's just not that expensive given the time and energy that you save in doing it. Nick, thank you. Thank you very much for joining Katie and I here today. And I wish you nothing but the best success with your company.
Thank you guys very much. It was awesome chatting with you and talking about my experiences and listening to you too. So I greatly appreciate it.
The podcast is Be You, The World Will Adjust. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.